Let me tell you a fun fact. Within the last two centuries, more than 90% of the world's millionaires have been created by investing in real estate. But if done incorrectly, without the right knowledge, required skills, or partners, it can also create a ton of problems and a lot of sleepless nights. You feel like sometimes there are way too many gurus out there trying to sell you on a weekend course, or just too much noise to cut right to the facts? Yup. We did too, and this is why we started this podcast. Our goal is to provide real estate investors, entrepreneurs, and enthusiasts with all of the most recent knowledge, secrets, tips, tricks, and tactics so that you can grow your own portfolios, increase your returns, net worth, and most importantly, create generational wealth for you and your loved ones. Remember, this is your real estate career. Information is your sword and shield. So eat hearty, prepare for battle, and grind your way to victory. My name is Tejas Gosai. I'm joined by my partner, Jeremy Moyer, and we welcome you to the Real Estate Investor MBA podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to your favorite real estate podcast. It's Real Estate Investor MBA. I have my partner, Jeremy Moyer.
How's it going?
And I'm Tejas Gosai. We always have an awesome show for everyone. We're on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play. And we love you guys. Check out our new website, www.rei.mba. We have some great tips, tricks, and different just negotiation tactics that we're sharing with a lot of folks. So check that out. And Jeremy, let's get into our interview. Good one today.
Absolutely. So we had Joe Marquez, also known as Cowboy Joe, with us today. So, you know, the majority of Joe's 39-year work experience has been in construction, project management, real estate development, environmental remediation. You know, Joe's been involved in numerous real estate development projects across the U.S., ranging from turnkey subdivisions, multifamily, 5,000-bed crew lodges, golf front condos, resorts, commercial buildings, mixed use, and marinas. He's been involved in some unique projects in several other countries in the Caribbean, South America. All these projects have ranged in value from $1.2 million to $100 million plus. Now, his mission is developing real estate and entrepreneurs' minds to get them to know who they are and how powerful they truly are. What do you think, Tejas? I mean, I think the interview today was just tremendous.
Awesome. As somebody who has built new construction hotels and gas stations and retail, it is awfully difficult, demanding 24 hours a day, a lot of speculation, investors' money, different debt structures. But he nailed it. This is the first time we've ever talked about land.
Yeah, no, it was great. This episode was on the pitfalls of land development. And I thought he did a tremendous job just kind of, again, there's so much. So, I mean, it's don't take this as like the only things you have to worry about. There's a lot to, this is your first step, you know, going towards learning more about development, you know, continue learning and find a mentor and a partner that knows more about it and just continue taking action.
Yeah. Joe's accessible too. You can contact him anytime.
Welcome back, everyone. We're excited for our interview today. We have Joe Marquez with us. Joe, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on the show. Looking forward to seeing what value I can add.
Welcome. That's- welcome. This is the only time I'm going to get to you that use this. I'm Indian, so it's cowboys and Indians today.
That's great.
Thanks for being here.
Joe, can you take a few minutes and give our listeners an idea about who the real Cowboy Joe is and, you know, how you got started in real estate investing? And I'm curious on how you got the nickname as well.
Well, I'm still trying to figure that out. I'm a little slow. I don't know why they call me Cowboy Joe. I guess I was born with a hat and boots on. Funny that Tejas talks about cowboys and Indians, because I was actually a little conflicted growing up because I am part Indian and a cowboy. So I guess I was always at war with myself anyway. So anybody wanted to start a fight, I was always ready.
There you go. That's awesome.
I was raised on a ranch, and I believe I've had land in my blood pretty much since the day I was born, because my granddaddy was always improving the ranch, doing different things, moving things around, building work sheds, barns, our houses, everything else. So I think land was just in the blood.
There you go.
I ended up doing big developments later in life because I was a government contractor. And when I transitioned out of the government space and got into the private, land development just, it was a natural fit.
Great. Yeah. We don't have too long, so we got to get through a bunch of this stuff. Jeremy, we got some prepared questions if you want to start firing them off.
We do. So, you know, we're going to specifically talk about land development today, and more specifically, the pitfalls of land development. You know, like I said, since we only have, like he just mentioned, about 30 minutes of time, so I'm sure the content that we could cover could fill several books and courses. So we'll probably only be scratching the surface with some of the topics today. But Joe, you know, I like to focus on land and, you know, probably not overpaying for it. You know, how do you value the land? Do you buy it outright? Do you lock it up on an option contract? Can you just spend a few minutes providing some high level nuggets for our listeners on that specific subtopic?
And overpaying for land is a big pitfall that a lot of beginning investors do make, because they value it based on what they think they can get approved project wise versus what the land is worth the way it sits. Mm-hmm. And that's great if the project's approved, but if it's not approved, then all of a sudden you own land that you can't get rid of because you're not going to be able to get that project approved at any point in time and without making modifications. But just an example, if you buy a parcel of land and you figure you can get 100 lots on it, but you can't get approved for 100 lots, and you base the value of your purchase on the fact you were going to be able to get 100 lots, the odds are you way overpaid for that land, especially if based on zoning regulations, you can only get 40 lots. And the value of those 40 lots is still the same price per lot as the price per lot for 100 lots. Then, yeah, you way overpaid for the land if you valued it based on 100 lots.
Is that, I mean, that has to be the driving force too. What project it's going to be? Is it residential, commercial? What type of land development deals have you specifically, you know, worked on?
Well, I've basically developed everything that can be developed other than high rises. I have not done skyscrapers. I've got a good friend of mine that's called Skyscraper King that I can call him if I had a client that was interested in that. But I have developed marinas, mixed use, hotels, residential, commercial, and literally a little bit of everything. And on that note, that's another pitfall, is a lot of people will buy land without looking at what the zoning is. And if the surrounding area and the zoning does not commit or does not allow those and doesn't support what you're trying to do, then again, you'll have a project that you can't get approved, and you probably overpaid for the land again. But even if you didn't overpay for it, you've still got to completely rethink what you're wanting to do with that project. And on that note, it's much simpler to downzone than upzone. Ideally, you buy land that is zoned for what your intended use is, but you can get something rezoned. Just keep in mind, it's easier to downzone typically than it is to upzone. And basically, downzone is reducing density or reducing the intensity of the use of land through the project.
I've seen a ton of this in my younger years. I was developing hotels and gas stations and retail. There was always a feasibility study, and typically there's a bank involved. I'm assuming that's how you guys function, or, you know, how you tether all the, you know, documents together to make the project go.
And it depends on the size and scope of the project, whether or not you need to do a physical feasibility study. Most, if you're dealing with, especially if you're dealing with professional investment funds or family offices, then yes, you will do a physical feasibility study, projects that you can use commercial banks, and you've got a track record, you may not necessarily have to do a physical feasibility study. And when I say physical, that's with an F. A lot of people also, economic feasibility study is another terminology that people use.
So Joe, we touched the base upon a few due diligence items, the feasibility study that you just mentioned, zoning. You definitely want to know if you can build per right, how it's currently zoned, or if you need to go through the variance process, right, to up zone, down zone, as you just mentioned. What other, before locking land up, either buying it outright or even on an option contract, like what other due diligence are you doing up front before actually purchasing the dirt or putting an option on the dirt to do more research?
Okay, some of the biggest ones are, first and foremost, is environmental, at least a phase one environmental assessment. And that's even if you're looking at, quote, farmland that's never had anything on it, because a lot of, especially big farmers, didn't realize it was a problem if they had a ravine that they needed to get rid of excess herbicides, pesticides, things like that. They just dumped in the ravine, not thinking anything about it. And you very well could have a problem on what's considered raw farmland. Then the next thing is wetlands, endangered species. Those can drastically impact whether or not you can do anything. Wetlands determine what your actual usable area is. And a lot of people are like, well, I'm on a mountain, I don't have wetlands. But if you've got a stream that is anywhere close to it, you can have a hillside that the closest water is a half a mile away and have wetlands, because it's not the presence of water that determines wetlands. It's the actual plant growth and soil microbes determine wetlands. So get a third-party wetland study, unless you're just 100% certain there's no wetlands involved. At least call them, ask them their opinion on it. And then endangered species. Where we do most of our active developments now, down here on the Gulf Coast, we have the white-footed beach mouse, which is considered an endangered species. And he's a bigger pain to deal with than most humans are run across. Basically, if you're doing commercial development down here and it's determined that that's his prime habitat, your property is, you basically have to buy him replacement property at a 2-to-1 ratio of equal or greater quality. So
do you move them?
Break a project quick.
Do you move them, or where? How do you do that?
No, you just buy that property so that they got a second home, vacation home. You don't have to move them. They'll still be living there. You won't get rid of them. And I'm really not certain they're endangered, because they're almost as thick as the tourists down here.
That's great.
But prime habitat is very expensive. So if you have to replace it in a 2-to-1 value, if you're, say you're covering 22,000 square foot on your project, you have to buy them on 2-to-1 basis. You have to buy an acre of land to offset it. So if you didn't factor in that $2 million purchase of an additional acre of land, because most of his habitat is beachfront, and the fact that there's very little of it left, then you're looking at something that could completely shut down a project, bust a project entirely. So you'd end up with a mouse habitat beachfront property that you can't build anything on.
That's a great story. So what about, people are worried about money. Investors are looking at return, and like everything we've kind of talked about right now, it makes the projects very difficult. So you get through this. How are these projects, which I'm assuming are multi-million dollar projects or
I don't know, more than that, $100 million projects. When it goes well, how does the funding work? What kind of lending institutions do you work with? How does it get done?
And that's actually another pitfall that a lot of people fall into when they first start in land development, is undercapitalized or improper capital structure. And me personally, there's only two ways I'll take down land before I have a completely approved project. One is cash, either my cash or an equity partner's cash, and preferably equity partner's cash, because that frees my cash up to do more projects. The more I can keep my cash available, the more projects I can do simultaneously. Whereas if I put all of my cash into one project, I'm locked into that one project. And a lot of people resist that until they realize that 50% of 10 pies is way more money than 100% of one pie. So that's the first thing. And then if I have to take down land before a project is approved and I have to use debt, I will only use what's called accruing interest-only loans. That's basically you don't have an obligation to make payments until a certain time frame that you've negotiated. The reason for that, another pitfall, is most people underestimate the time frame it takes to get a project approved, and you can go broke making payments and interest on land to get a project approved. Now, on that, if you do take down the land with accruing interest, you want to make sure that your interest is less, at least equal to or less than what the area's appreciation rate is, or if not, you create a negative spread. A negative spread just means that your note is growing in value faster than your land is. So you end up, you're losing margin as time goes on.
Joe, do you have any... I guess every project's a little different, and depending what you're looking to do with the land. But to give the listeners just a ballpark on timing, I mean, time, it could be like you just mentioned, it could be a friend to, you know, long-term hold investors. You know, time's great with the inflation of rent and fixed cost of debt. But then it could be your foe, as you just mentioned, what you just said. Do we have... Can it be a year? Can it be 10 years? I mean, I'm sure it depends on what you tackle and what you see, especially with zoning. But on a normal, you did everything right up front, due diligence, it's zoned the way you need it to be zoned, or you know you're going to be able to get the variance. What's a normal time frame look like?
And you said it varies greatly, mm-hmm. And it varies from area to area. Like the fastest time frame is something that is by right. That means that the land's already zoned the way you want it, and you're below density, meaning that you're putting something that is not to maximum capacity mm-hmm. of that project. And then making sure you got community support. Because if you're trying to put something in that the community's going to get against you, you end up having public meetings to get these projects approved. Yeah. And if you can get out ahead of these meetings and do a community rally, get people behind you, the people that are having these meetings are either elected officials or appointed and getting paid by elected officials. And they're not going to go against the community or the perception of what the community wants. And you'll learn that the negative people will show up without much prodding. But the positive people usually don't show up. So you want to get and do a community outreach and get the positive people on your side and get them to the meeting so that the perception is that there's more support than opposition. Realistically, something that's by right and is fairly easy, as long as you do a little bit of work in advance, 6 months is a good time frame to figure on getting a project approved. I usually tell all of my clients and students to figure double whatever it is. So if you're thinking 6 months, figure a year. That gives you some room for things to go wrong. Now, more in-depth projects could be a two-year time frame. And in California, there are projects that it can take you 3 to 5 years to get approved, depending on how many different steps you have to go through.
Mm-hmm. And are you able to get accruing debt for that long? Like, what kind of, on the accruing debt side, what type of terms do you see banks provide on that type of product?
Well, it's hard to find. There's a few banks that will do accruing debt at that level, but that's not for the beginning investor. That's for experienced investors that have a track record. And I've gotten accruing debt loans for 10 years, but it was a very viable project, and the actual land was worth twice as much as what I was buying it for, and they were perfectly happy with doing accruing debt because they knew that the land was worth way more than what they had in it.
And they're assessing the risk. Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. So Joe, in your opinion, you know, let's say a listener, an investor's listening to this interview and they've been kicking around the idea of doing, you know, land development projects and not really knowing where to start. You know, how important is it for them to seek, you know, proper counsel from others or even those experienced in development, maybe even partnering up with them, you know, to navigate those pitfalls, you know, that we've been kind of discussing? How, what's your opinion on that?
Well, it's critical. Mm-hmm. I don't care. Forget beginning investor, experienced investors. My background is environmental science, but I pay third parties to do phase one environmental studies because they're the experts, they're the ones with the liability, and they are familiar with the areas and the history of it. Same thing with the economic feasibility studies. Using experts saves you money. Flat out, they're not a cost, they're an investment. They're worth way more than what you pay them. And same thing with, I partner with other developers on different projects. It just depends on whether or not it is 100% my area of expertise or if it's something I'm familiar with, but there's people that have greater knowledge than me. The more people with experience that you put into a project, number one, the faster it goes. Number two, the higher the margins are, and it's just a better quality project all the way around.
Do you have another nugget that you can put out there as another pitfall in land development that you want to share with those listening?
One thing that is something I ran across recently and I've been developing for years is easements. Yeah. And that's both easements across your property that you're potentially buying, but also if your property is not direct road frontage, but has roads going into it, make certain that you've got the easements in place for that, that it's not just a road that's been used, and make sure the easements are improvable easements. Two examples. One, we were looking at a project in South Dakota in the Black Hills. Beautiful property. We're going to make a real high-end subdivision out of it. However, it had an easement running dead through the center of it for a neighbor to be able to move cattle from one pasture to another during season changes. Well, it's kind of hard to have houses and yards and streets if your cattle are running through the middle of it twice a year. And we talked to the neighbor, wouldn't move the easement because that was the best place to work for him. So we ended up not doing that project. But a recent project that I actually did, and this just, I mean, something, again, don't assume, check the records. We bought a property that had 150 foot of state park land between it and the road. And there was improved driveways across it. However, there were never any easements put in place. So we got delayed almost 10 months negotiating those easements and getting the easements in place. So regardless of how much experience you got, use the checklist and make sure you do your own due diligence and follow up.
Here, thanks for that, Jeremy. I got one last one. How about tax benefits, 1031 exchange? You know, just QOZ. There's different opportunity zones. How does that play in to what you're doing? And can you give a couple examples?
Well, I do take advantage of opportunity zones. There's a couple opportunity zones around where we're at. I have a client that has a opportunity zone project in South Carolina that's a big mixed-use property. It's going to be a travel center, restaurant, hotels, a couple of other things on it, and it's inside of an opportunity zone. The biggest thing is that is you're able to offset capital gains from other things, other investments, plus that doesn't have the capital gain attached to it. I don't do 1031 exchange in development as much because of going to an ever greater project. I stay within a range that I want to work with now. So I can't speak to 1031 exchanges as much, but opportunity zones are excellent ways to offset capital gains.
For the investors like it.
That makes sense. So Joe, I like to ask this question as our last question quite often. So I call it the next steps advice. So let's say our listener, like I mentioned before, is an investor, is thinking about land development, or just not sure where to get started. You know, what's one piece of advice that's actionable, that is a next step that, you know, if they're listening to this, they can, you know, right after they listen to the episode, they could do right away. What's something that you can give them?
Well, I would say find a mentor, and I actually do that, but it doesn't have to be me. Find somebody that is a land developer in your area, if that's what you want, and see if they were willing to mentor you. I have courses and have a book coming out in about 3 months as well, but I have courses. I mentor. I have a lot of clients from coast to coast. But I would say the biggest thing is research and then start taking action. A lot of people get an analysis paralysis. They'll go to 15 different classes and never take action. Start learning your research and what it takes to do the land development, and then start looking at property. Get a property under contract. And getting it under contract is not scary. Put in contingencies to where you've got time to do your due diligence. I've actually put property under contract that I'm not going to close on it until I have an approved project on it. And people that own land, especially in highly developable areas, are already familiar with that's what it takes a lot of time to be able to sell land. So that's not that hard to negotiate. And that's just negotiation skills as far as what time you can get it negotiated.
How can listeners get a hold of you if they wanted to talk to you more, find out more about your courses or even your book? How can they do that?
Well, the easiest way is www.cowboyjoe.me. That's usually fairly easy to remember. And it has all of my events that come up. It has a way to schedule time to do a one-on-one call with me. I do an initial consult. If you already have projects that you're actively involved in and want to talk to me and see if we're a fit, if I can help you, would love to do that. And then I do a wisdom chat that anybody can come to once a month. And it's the first Wednesday of each month that I do a deep dive on either land development or some topic in land development or digital assets in the cryptocurrency space.
Nice. Love it. Love it. Thanks. Thanks, Joe. Great interview. We'll have you back on one day in the future. But thanks for the time.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it. Truly enjoy it.
This is Tejas Gosai. I got my partner, Jeremy Moyer. It's Real Estate Investor MBA. And Cowboy Joe, thank you. Cowboys and Indians special today. We appreciate you guys.
Perfect. Thank you.